where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And we're going to look at something that has a lot of mystery behind it, but I think we have the perfect person to help demystify it. And I'm talking about our guest today, John Michael Greer. He is the author of the recent book, The Ceremony of the Grail, Ancient Mysteries, Gnostic Heresies, and The Lost Rituals of Freemasonry. We're so glad to have him with us. And he has quite the background, and we're so glad to have him. He is one of the most respected writers on the occult today, a teacher as well, and he's written more than 50 books on esoteric traditions, nature, spirituality, and the future of industrial society. As an initiate in Druid, Hermetic, and Masonic lineages, he served for 12 years as the Grand Arch Druid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America. He lives in Rhode Island with his wife, Sarah, and he can be found online at ecosophia.net. John Michael Greer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So let's start at kind of the base level here. When somebody talks about the Grail, the Holy Grail, in your mind, are we talking about something physical? Are we talking about a concept? Are we talking about a philosophy? Are we talking about all of those and more? When we talk about the Grail, what exactly are we talking about?
That's where it gets interesting right from the beginning, because one of the great challenges is figuring out what the Grail actually is. In fact, in some of the old Grail legends, the question that the knight has to ask when he gets to the Grail castle is, what is the Grail? It's the one legend I know of in anywhere in the world where the crucial thing is not finding the answer, but asking the right question. And so There have been, of course, many theories. There's the claim that the Holy Grail was a physical object, the claim that it was, for example, the cup that Jesus of Nazareth used at the Last Supper, mm-hmm. various other claims and speculations, their claims it's a concept. The writer whose work was central to my book, a writer back in the very late 19th and early 20th centuries, Jesse Weston, argued that it was a ceremony, that what we have in the old Grail legends are dim memories or scrambled accounts of a ritual of initiation, and that was the secret hiding behind the Grail, or one of the secrets hiding behind the Grail.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I mean, I think in popular culture, many people got familiar with it from the Dan Brown books. Uh-huh. And that was maybe a kind of a 101 entree. I don't know how accurate it was, but it kind of introduced people to the concept maybe who weren't familiar before.
Well, it's a fun book. And one of the things that makes the whole Grail tradition so fascinating is so much of it is in the form of stories. It's not, you know, dry as dust philosophy or this kind of stuff. Here's a story about someone who goes on an adventure, goes seeking something, and maybe finds it and maybe doesn't. So Dan Brown is kind of in that tradition.
Now, the subtitle, Ancient Mysteries, Gnostic Heresies, and the Lost Rituals of Freemasonry. So where does Freemasonry come in?
Okay. Yeah, there we start getting fun. Of course, as you mentioned to our to our listeners, I am Freemason. I've been initiated a whole bunch of different Masonic rites and traditions. And one of the things that's most interesting about those is that in many cases, we don't know where they came from. People scoop them up, or here's this tradition, or here the most important ritual in Masonry, the Master Mason's degree, the third degree of ancient craft Masonry. Nobody knows where it came from. Hmm. It just shows up. And so one of the things that I was doing in the course of the research that led up to this book was looking into the origins of some of these strange old initiation rituals. What did they originally mean? Where did they come from? Who created them and why? Now, one of the complex things about the Master Mason's degree, as I said, it just kind of popped up. When Masonic lodges first went public in 1717 in London, there were four of them at that time in London, various others elsewhere in England and Scotland. But there were two degrees that they worked. There was the entered apprentice and the fellow craft mystery, the first and second degrees. The whole system requires a third degree. So what happened? Where was the third degree? Now, in 1715, there was an attempt at revolution in England. That was part of the long war between the House of Hanover, who were Protestants, and the House of Stuart, who were Catholics. Mm-hmm. And there was an attempted, the then head of the House of Stuart tried to seize power in England. There was the attempted revolution. There was a war. The Stuarts were badly defeated and chased back to Europe. And immediately after that, like 2 years later, the Masons surfaced. Now, a lot of people, a lot of supporters of the Stuarts fled England. And so it looks as though they may have taken the people who in London who knew how to do the original third degree, took it with them and didn't leave the necessary materials for anyone else to do it. And so where did the Master Mason degree came from? It popped up in about 1720. And was it the original third degree? I argue that it wasn't. I argued that a different ritual had originally filled that place, and that we can reconstruct some elements of it from various sources. So masonry was a very complex thing in those days. Of course, it's become rather stodgy these days, despite the efforts of conspiracy theorists to insist that the evil Masons are out to run the world. Most of the Masonic lodges I have been familiar with are just about up to deciding, who's going to make coffee at the end of the next meeting. These are not world conquerors here. But they're great guys. They're preserving an ancient tradition. They're trying to do good in the world, trying to improve themselves. But the secret overlords of all creation, not hardly. You need to meet these guys to know how funny that is. But at any rate, digging into these old rituals, digging into these sources and the various complex traditions that fed into the rise of modern Freemasonry starting in 1717 was a very important part of the research that led me to confirm Jesse Weston's theory that the Grail was based on an initiation ritual, actually that came by way of the old Gnostics, thus Gnostic heresies. And that had actually that actually tied back into the old Greek mystery traditions, which were another set of initiations in ancient times. There you have the subtitle: the ancient mysteries, the Gnostic heresies, and the lost rituals of Freemasonry.
Now, you talk in the book about keepers of the secret. Are there people who currently or in the past who kind of held that secret and knew what the Grail really was? I mean, about the gentleman who wrote the book that your work is based on. Was he one of those keepers? No, what do you mean by keepers of secret?
Not a gentleman. Jesse Weston was one of the first women to break into.
What happens when you assume? And I'm not going to finish that, but yes.
But we all know where it goes. Yeah, no, Jesse Weston was one of the first women to break into the field of folklore studies. And one of the first women to get a really thorough kind of college education in Europe, in major European universities and so on. And she started out as an ordinary researcher of folklore. She was fascinated by the legends of King Arthur. She was fascinated by the legends of the Holy Grail. She wrote books on the subject. She had some money, so she didn't have to knuckle under to any university or any other established institution. She just wrote good books and had a publisher that would publish them. And so as she studied this more and more, she began to become convinced that there was something behind this, something that either had lasted well into the Middle Ages or maybe a little longer. And then her last book comes out, and very cagily she lets on that the ritual still existed, that the ceremony of the Grail was still being practiced, and that she was in contact with the people involved. No reference as to where to find them. There are various hints that I was able to track down, but it took some serious work. I had to find an account of the Grail legend that she wrote, which was published in a little specialist occult periodical and has never been reprinted since that time. It was written in the form of a story, but it's basically an account of her understanding of the Grail, of the entire Grail initiation. And so, yeah, I'm pretty sure from the context that she, in fact, made contact with these people, that she became a member of the organization, that she received the initiation. Now, does it still exist? I don't know. The last I've been able to trace it is to about 1930, 1935, around there. It certainly existed then. It's almost 100 years ago. Now, of course, Britain has, this was in England,
mm-hmm.
And Britain has been through a lot since then. And there were a lot of occult traditions, a lot of secret teachings that were lost at various times in the 20th century. It was a rough time. And one of my other books was based on an attempt to reconstruct one of them from the surviving scraps. But is it possible there are still people who have this secret? Yes. Is it certain? No. I have no proof one way or the other. Maybe, you know, the way, just as Jesse Weston kept on publishing and publishing, and eventually somebody apparently, like, dropped her a line or something, maybe somebody will contact me one of these days. I don't know.
It would seem that it's at least a decent chance that it would have survived that way. I mean, obviously, you're right. The world in Britain specifically have been through a lot, but it would seem that someone may have
continued. It's possible.
Go ahead.
No, it's possible. Also, I'm pretty sure, based on some scraps of some of the information I gathered, that it had been more or less lost before that time and had to be revived sometime in the late 19th century. That somebody came across the documents and said, "Oh, puppy, look at this," and proceeded from there. In that case, that original source may still survive somewhere, or some other set of documents might turn up. So there's a lot of possibilities. In the meantime, though, there's enough information available that I was able to do a tentative reconstruction of the ritual, how it worked, right down to the details of how to perform the ceremony. As given my background, it was not too difficult for me to figure out a lot of this because I've done a lot of rituals, so a lot of initiation ceremonies. But that's in the latter part of this book, this new book of mine, is the actual, my reconstruction of the text of the ceremony of the Grail.
I don't want to give away the punchline. I mean, I don't want to give away what the ritual is, but I do want to ask some questions around mm-hmm. that question.
Oh, go ahead.
One is, and I'm guessing, I bet you sound like the person who would. Did you personally perform the ritual?
It requires a group of people. Where I am now, I don't happen to have a staff that I can organize to do it. So I have not actually performed the ritual of the Grail. I've done, the necessary meditations and some other things to make sure that it would work, but I have not actually performed the ritual.
Was it something that would imbue someone with powers or simply enhance or create some spiritual connection?
It's about spiritual connection. It's one thing that a lot of people who don't do a lot of occultism may not know is that you don't get powers from doing an initiation. And the word initiation literally means a beginning. You know, you initiate something, you begin something. An initiation ritual puts you into contact with certain spiritual energies. Then it's your job to do something about it. The same is true of religious rituals. You know, if you're okay, you become a Christian, you're baptized, right? That's an initiation. Now, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to do the prayer and the devotion and all the other things you need to do to develop that in your life or not? That's, it's exactly the same way in other traditions and in occultism. You go through an initiation. Okay, great. What are you going to do about it? There are practices. There are spiritual exercises. You do those. And then it goes someplace. And that's when the power comes in, by the way. It's not from the initiation. It's from your own labor.
Now, let me ask you this, because, and I'm going back in my memory bank about 15 years when I read that Dan Brown book. There's a lot of thought about the Holy Grail being representative of the sacred feminine. Was that part of the ritual, or is that herring?
When people start going the sacred feminine, as per Dan Brown, they typically are thinking of women with their clothes off, okay, and men with their clothes off too. That is not what this ritual is about. It does not involve any sexual activity. It doesn't require you not to engage in sexual activity in your own time, but it's not about sex magic. And so, while there is certainly a feminine dimension in the symbolism. Freud could have told you that.
Yeah.
One of the big differences between the old Gnostics and the more mainstream Christians is that the mainstream Christian churches, certainly back in the day, and of course in some branches even today, restrict holy things to men. You can't become a priest, you know, in some denominations if you're a woman. You can't have anything to do, any role except sitting in the congregation, maybe making coffee. The Gnostics disagreed with that sharply. The Gnostics believed that, in fact, Jesus hadn't transmitted a special initiation to Mary Magdalene, and that special initiation was available to women, that there was a place for women in holy activities, in sacred practices, and so on. And so that was something that you see in the Grail legends. When the Grail shows up in the old legends, it's usually being carried by a woman. And you have to put your mind in a medieval frame of mind to realize just how shocking that was, the thought that here's this sacred object, and a woman is carrying it. And so that ties into this Gnostic belief that women also can take part in sacred things, that women also have this potential for priestesshood, for sacred activity. So to that extent, you know, there's this feminine energy caught up in it, but don't think of it in terms of, you know, people, you know, taking their clothes off and doing the nasty right there in the ritual.
There you go. Question answered.
A lot of people want to know that one.
Well, I wasn't thinking quite in that direction. But yeah, I think there is possible that there is that overtone. So now that you mention it.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I recall, that was kind of pretty broadly hinted in Dan Brown's book.
Yeah, true. It has been quite a while since I read that, though, so my memory's probably shot in that respect. I mean, you know, this conversation, the part about the Masons and Freemasonry, mm-hmm. as someone who has experienced, you kind of said, you know, the biggest argument is, or biggest, like, conspiracy is about who's going to make the coffee. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it has such a mystique and people say, ah, those are the regular Masons, but there's the higher degree Masons who really mm-hmm. knows what's going on? Why are people so conspiratorial about the Masons?
Okay, well, to begin with, the Masons were not always, let's be fair, the Masons were not always conspiring over who makes the coffee, okay? I can tell you one major political revolution that was started by a bunch of Freemasons. That's the American Revolution.
Right.
I mean, the guys who founded this country were a flock of Masonic conspirators, and they had two secret societies they worked through, the Committees of Correspondence, and the Sons of Liberty, one of them which handled kind of the organizational things. The other one was the shock troops. And so, yeah, you know, the same thing actually happened in much of Latin America. Simon Bolivar, who was responsible for the revolutions that overthrew Spanish rule over most of Latin America, he was a Freemason. Most of the people he worked closely with were Freemasons, and the Masons helped organize the whole thing. So there was a time 150 years ago, 250 years ago, when Masons were involved in things like that. What happens? Well, what happens to every institution? Over time, something that started out very radical and very activist and very, it eventually becomes a place for grandpa to go. And I'm sure the thing is, look at your average Methodist church. Your average Methodist church, it's a worthy institution, but it's not the world's most exciting place. 200 years ago, the Methodists were screaming radicals.
No, that's true.
But makes everybody sense. Just kind of, you know, every institution sort of winds down over time and develops a routine and settles in. And so I think to some extent what's going on with the Masons is that people still remember what happened in 1776 and go, I bet they're still up to it. I suppose. But the other thing is, we live in a society where there's a lot of lip service given to charity. Okay, lots of people like to talk about, oh, it'd be really nice if someone did something about this social problem or that social problem. Now, the Masons, whatever else you can say about them, they're very active in charity. there's a lot of, there are hospitals and burn clinics and language centers for children and things like that. They're supported by Masons out of their own pockets. And that they don't make a fuss about it. They just, you know, get out there and do things. And so there's a lot of people who get very uncomfortable about that because they think that, well, you know, they probably should do that, but they're not willing to spare the money. You know, I'm thinking of some of the guys I know, some of these brother Masons who are, you know, they're elderly, they're living on a retirement pension. They're not necessarily the richest people in the world by a long shot, and yet they're cutting big checks every month to support this charity, to you know, help that family or what have you. People get uncomfortable about that because they see it and they go, I should be doing that, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to spend that kind of money, but I should be doing that. So that sort of ambivalence, mm-hmm, is easy to solve by saying, I know those Masons are actually evil, so I don't have to compare myself to them. I don't have to look at their charitable works and say, maybe I should be doing something to help. I think that's a lot of it. You know, people get really funny when it comes to the clash between what they pretend they are and what they actually act like.
No, that's, you know, that I've never thought about that. That is an excellent point. And yes, from everything I can glean, the Masons, mm-hmm, are very, very active, and hats off to them for doing that. That's fantastic.
You join the Masons, wear silly hats, engage in medieval, you know, strange medieval rituals that most Masons do not understand at all, and contribute a big chunk of your income and a lot of hours of work to making a better place in the world. It attracts people.
So let me ask you, that's another thing that I think is a little bit of the mystery, is the symbolism of the Masons. Mm-hmm. And it's, mm-hmm, really cool. It's really neat. You, mm-hmm, know, you look on your money, you see some of it, I think, in the U.S. at least. Talk to us a little bit about the symbolism, because I think that kind of wraps it in a mystique as well.
That's an important point. And a lot of the problem there is that we as a culture have dropped out of the habit of using symbolism. 150 years ago, people knew symbols just as a matter of course. It was part of your education. You grew up. Somebody could make a reference to the first locomotive as being an iron Jehu. What's a Jehu? Well, Jehu was a figure in the Bible, and who was noted for being a really fast wild chariot racer. So driving like Jehu is moving really fast, you know, maybe 20 whole miles an hour. And so to call the, you know, you could call something Iron Jehu and everyone would know what you meant. We've lost that. We've lost track of the idea that symbols can mean things. And so the Masons, which still have this kind of traditional use of symbol, look really weird now. But a lot of the Masonic symbolism is used to be very standard. You know, you have the beehive. That's a symbol of industry, a symbol of work. Because bees are always busy, you know, busy, mm-hmm, like the busy bees. You have the anchor, which is a symbol of hope, and so on. There are others that tie into the ritual, you know, the branch of acacia, of the acacia tree, and things like that. And some of those are things that Masons have promised not to talk about with non-Masons. That's, you know, one of those traditional things. You can find all the details online in about five. You know, if it takes you 5 minutes, your Google foo is not very good. but you know, and the thing is, this has been true since the 1700s. There have been books. Actually, I think the very late 1600s was when the first books revealing the secrets of Masonry were published. But the old promise is still expected. You're still expected to make it. You don't talk about it with non-Masons. And, you know, it's an odd thing, but it's one of the traditions, one of, as we call them, the ancient landmarks that we keep, even though, you know, anyone with access to a search engine can find out the whole shebang.
Now, I am certainly not saying that I agree with this, because if I agreed, mm-hmm, with it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But some people may say, you know, this is a long time ago. It doesn't relate to my life. Why should I care about the Holy Grail? Why should I care about the Freemasons? Mm-hmm. Why should I care about symbolisms? Why should I care about the ceremony of the Grail? What would you say to them?
It's a great question, but it has an answer. I would encourage my readers to look at the world around them. And look at the way the world is going right now and say, does this make you confident? Does this give you hope? Is this the kind of world you want to live in? Is it going a direction you like? Well, and if all that's true, if you look at the world right now and say, wow, this is great, and it's just getting better, and I, you know, then you probably don't need to know anything about any of that old stuff. You can just sort of coast along into some kind of whatever the future has in store for us. If you look at the world and say, well, you know, maybe I think some mistakes were made, well, you know, when you've been driving down a road and you come out to a dead end, you know, there's the end of the road, there's the yellow and black barred sign. If you want to keep going anywhere at all, the first requirement is to back up.
Mm-hmm.
To go back the way you came and figure out where you made a false turn. And that's the basis. That's the reason why history is always important. If you think that a mistake has been made, you need to back up. You need to go back the way you came and figure out where the problems were. A lot of what's going on in the history of something like the Holy Grail is talking about how we as a culture ran off the rails, how we got stuck in this particular mode of thinking, this very materialistic, this very rigid and dogmatic materialist view of the world that is not working out very well for us. And the ceremony of the Grail is one of the roads we didn't take. The traditions of the Grail tie into a lot of very strange things, and some of them are potentially very useful things. Freemasonry, 200 years ago, when Alexis de Tocqueville traveled the United States and wrote a book about it, one of the most important things about it that he saw in American culture was that people were getting together in these voluntary organizations to solve problems. Nowadays, we've lost that. Maybe we need to reclaim that. The Masons offer one way of doing that. I could go on, you know. But ultimately, it comes down to what do you think about the world? What do you think about the way it's headed? And if you're comfortable with that, then my book probably has nothing to offer you. If you have your doubts, maybe it's time to look at something different.
Well, I would certainly say this. I think it would take a unique person to look at the world right now and say that everything is hunky-dory.
There must be someone.
There might
somewhere.
Be somebody out there that thinks it's great, but
probably in Congress.
That could be, but certainly not present company. And that's why one of the reasons of many that I hope that everybody checks out the Ceremony of the Grail. John Michael Greer, where can people find the book and all of your other work? Because this is just one of many.
This is just one of many. I like to write. Yes. Okay, if you want to find, it will be available in all the usual online places. If you want to go to bookshop.org, which is the place where I have my own shop, it's bookshop.org/JMG, or just go through bookshop.org. They have copies. They will have copies as fast as anybody. But if you want to use one of the other online sellers, or if you have a full, you know, a local bookstore that will order things for you, they'd love to hear from you.
Very good. Our guest has been John Michael Greer. The book is The Ceremony of the Grail. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such an enlightening conversation, and I hope everybody checks out the book. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. What a great guest John Michael is. Happy Thanksgiving, and I'm sure John Michael would agree. Keep exploring those mysteries. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.